This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kulhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. There has long been a housing crisis in American cities, well before COVID-19 struck. Now, 3 years into the pandemic, there is an ongoing crisis in housing. But in cities like Los Angeles and Baltimore, residents are organizing and resisting. Even more importantly, they're envisioning and implementing innovative solutions based in housing justice. Writing about these solutions at Yes Magazine as part of a new series called Building the Block is my guest, Jaisal Noor, a democracy program manager at Solutions Journalism Network. He wrote two articles for the series. Welcome to the program, Jaisal.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in full disclosure for our audience, I was your editor on these two stories, and it was a joy to work with you, and a very exciting set of stories as well. Let's start in Los Angeles. This is where I am based. You flew out to LA to cover housing justice. You've been a Baltimore-based journalist for a long time, and you have seen how the housing justice has played out in Baltimore. Tell me about the activism that you found here in Los Angeles around, and it's really rooted in racial justice, the activism around housing justice that you founded in Los Angeles, some of the players, the organizations involved.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important story because as housing justice activists, you know, we'll tell you, we'll remind us that housing is so fundamental for the health of a society. And you look at cities where housing in crisis in Baltimore, in Los Angeles, and so many other places around the world, and you see cities in distress, communities in distress, and a lot of this is rooted in a legacy of racially segregated housing, discriminatory housing policies, and people have been fighting back for generations. But today, the article I wrote covers how activists are fighting on several different fronts. On the short term, activists are fighting for continuing eviction moratorium, which the LA City Council voted to end, to sunset, like so many other COVID renters protections that have lapsed, even though the pandemic is still with us. Many people still cannot afford to pay rent, and predicted eviction tsunami continues to be a possibility as these protections lift up. So in the absence of state intervention, community activists with the group Los Angeles Tenants Union have organized renters. They've taken collective action. They've had some really big wins. And so I got to spend time with one such renter and helped, she was able to share her story about the challenges she faced with a landlord that she would describe as a slumlord who...
This is Erica Jackson.
Erica Jackson. And, you know, she's a single mother was facing what she describes as an unjust, illegal eviction. And thankfully for her, she was able to get some legal representation, and that makes a huge difference, because if you do not have legal representation in places like Los Angeles or in Baltimore, you are far more likely to face eviction. So she was her case is ongoing, but the eviction has been delayed for now. And so on the short term, these activists are making gains or helping keep people in their homes. And the long term, you have groups like Downtown Crenshaw, which is fighting for community land trust and community ownership of housing, of land in historically Black areas of LA, where Black people are being pushed out, where there's been rapid gentrification. And the same activists have been fighting for resources for these neighborhoods. And so, for example, they successfully fought and won getting a metro stop there. But along with the construction of the metro stop has been a drastic rise of housing prices, which is forcing out longtime residents. And so through community land trusts, which are community owned and community controlled, these groups like Downtown Crenshaw are are fighting for a different solution, which is a long-term solution. You know, it's going to take years to implement, but they have raised tens of millions of dollars to buy up land and make it affordable permanently for residents, and specifically targeting this Black neighborhood and communities that have thrived for generations despite the racial discrimination they have faced.
So just to summarize, then, the short-term work is being done through groups like the LA Tenants Union, where basically people facing eviction, like Erica Jackson, are banding together. Collective action works better than individual action usually. There's strength in numbers. And then in the long term, rather than leaving individuals to the whim of landlords, groups like Downtown Crenshaw are buying up land for use and to ensure that it remains affordable. How successful have these efforts been, both the short term and the long term? I know Downtown Crenshaw has had a lot of struggle in facing an intransigent city council, but also developers, real estate developers. How successful have these efforts been at actually getting people to stay in homes?
Yeah, so with the LA Tenants Union, they have about 3,000 members, and their membership has grown exponentially since the start of the pandemic. You know, it's important to remember that this housing crisis existed before the pandemic, but it was greatly exacerbated by the pandemic. Thousands, or you know, tens of millions of people lost their jobs and the ability to pay rent or mortgages. So the LA Tenants Union has successfully helped fight for dozens of tenants to stay in their homes and have the city actually move towards buying a property that had been under rent control, but those rent protections had lapsed. And so they pressured the city to actually buy this private property. Those negotiations are ongoing. And beyond that, through collective action, they prevented the evictions of hundreds of residents and are still fighting for the eviction moratorium to be extended in LA. Downtown Crenshaw, they had put a bid in, actually it was the highest bid, to buy a 40-acre mall that was being redeveloped in Crenshaw last year, but that bid was rejected by the developer that was selling the property.
Which is such an interesting story because, you would think that it's about dollars and cents, it's just about money. They put in the highest bid and they were still turned down, which suggests that what they wanted to do with that land, with that property, was something that the real estate developer saw as a threat in the long term to the interests of real estate developers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the threat of a good example is something that the powerful do not want to see implemented. So that was snuffed out before it could happen. And a lot of countries that have far better social indicators, like in Europe, for example, the state has built social housing, has invested a lot of money in quality public housing that also gives residents a lot of agency in how that housing is implemented and the services that are provided with it. And those societies have far longer life expectancy, are much safer, have less crime. And so there is a great opposition to that kind of thinking, that kind of approach being implemented in the US, especially in LA, which is one of the most expensive housing markets. And so that really was a blow for Downtown Crenshaw. They are still challenging that decision in court, which, they face an uphill battle. The legal system, as we know, tends to favor the wealthy and the powerful. But in the meantime, they were able to raise more than $100 million. And so they are taking that money and investing it in purchasing smaller plots of land. So by the spring of this year, they will have about 10 plots of land, and they'll be developing that into rental properties community land trusts, which provide long-term leases for families and an opportunity to build wealth when those families leave those houses. And in terms of evidence, they point to other community land trusts One of the leaders of downtown Crenshaw was involved in Boston's Dudley neighborhood land trust, which is housing hundreds of primarily Black residents in that neighborhood in Boston, which itself was the result of decades of struggle there. And so there is evidence that things like community land trust, decreases eviction, it builds wealth, it builds prosperity, and it shows the power of community action.
So let's go to the story that you wrote for Yes about Baltimore. You're based in Baltimore and have covered the fight for housing justice there for a long time. What are some of the similarities that you see with what's happening in LA? I know that there are efforts in Baltimore as well around land trusts, around tenants banding together. Tell me about the story that you wrote for Yes around housing justice in Baltimore.
Yeah, and so the similarities are that both of these cities have historic populations of Black and Latinx and communities of color that have been historically, their communities have been historically disinvested. They've been excluded from home ownership opportunities. Obviously, the housing market in LA is much stronger. It's more expensive to buy land in LA, whereas in Baltimore, housing properties are lower, which makes it more affordable, but housing prices have increased, rents have increased during the pandemic. And also there is something like 15,000 vacant homes whose landlords have fled the city or have been left in ruin. And this has depressed housing values in Black neighborhoods in the city. So they're taking a similar approach. There's groups in terms of strategy, there's groups fighting eviction for long-term residents that are being displaced by rising rents. And there's also a community land trust movement, a tool that Baltimore City has used to push out long-term residents is eminent domain. And something that I wrote about in a neighborhood in Poppleton, which is very near downtown Baltimore, a historically Black neighborhood where gentrification has slowly been creeping in. About 15 years ago, the entire neighborhood was essentially handed over to a developer who never followed through on his promises to actually develop the land. He so far built only two properties while clearing out entire city blocks. And most of those were renters, and the former residents were renters and were forced out by the city. But Sonia Eady, a third generation Poppleton resident, never gave up her fight. And, her story is incredible because eventually, through the mobilization of a citywide coalition, the city agreed to intervene on her behalf with the developer and stopped the use of eminent domain to seize her home. And now she's working, part of that settlement with the city will help rehab some of those homes that were in really poor condition and help them get rehabilitated and put in the ownership of the longtime residents who were renters and turn those rentals into properties that will be home ownership opportunities for those renters. And it's also part of a bigger strategy by groups here of helping local residents turn these, old homes that were vacant for a long time and help fix them up and make them livable for residents. And these vacant homes, primarily exist in disinvested redline neighborhoods. So there are a lot of challenges there, but there's a lot of hope there too, because there is housing stock. And that's something that LA doesn't have. There is housing stock in Baltimore, and if resources are directed towards investing and rehabbing those homes, there's more than enough homes to house the population in Baltimore that's living in housing insecurity or is homeless.
Just as we discussed the power of a good example or example of justice in LA can reverberate, how has in Baltimore, what Sonia Eady's victory, how has that had a ripple effect? Do you see her approach and her success potentially being replicated as she works with others like her?
Yeah. And so I asked Sonia about this, and she told me that other groups that are facing, you know, all other neighborhoods are facing the same cycle of long-time disinvestment. Developer comes in, promises to revitalize a neighborhood, but then falls short on those promises. So she's been talking to other neighborhoods across the city that are fighting displacement and that want a different vision for what their neighborhood can look like. And so the fact that she was able to pull this off when very few people have been able to do so in Baltimore's history has given people hope and, you know, has given people a blueprint of what can happen through collective action and also being able to articulate a vision, which what Sonia Eady and other Poppleton residents did. They had a Poppleton plan. So critics will often say, well, if you don't want these developers to come in, then, you know, what, you know, do you want to leave things the way they are? Do you want these neighborhoods to remain disinvested? And their answer is no. Like, we have a vision. We want this neighborhood to be livable. We want to retain the historical character of these neighborhoods. We want services and grocery stores that people can afford here. You know, we want to invest in parks. We want to invest in pools. And so I think a vision has been articulated, and I think we'll see a lot more examples of community-driven development in the future versus just this top-down developer envisioned community revitalization in quotes, which has not really panned out in Baltimore. You know, Baltimore has given out hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks and incentives to developers, and you know, there's still a massive shortage of affordable housing. The city is becoming increasingly unlivable. We still have a really high crime rate, high murder rate, and housing can be a solution to a lot of these really pressing problems.
And in fact, that's a really good point. The issue of the tax incentives and credits, and you write about this in your story in Baltimore. I mean, this is sort of like a trickle-down economics, right? If we give money to the real estate developers, magically we'll have more affordable housing. And of course, they end up hoarding the money, just like you see trickle-down economics not working in other sectors of the economy. And so how are housing justice activists in Baltimore pointing this out and saying, instead of pouring in money at the top, put it directly toward the people who need it, toward the infrastructure that needs it, rather than incentivizing a for-profit entity to and you know, begging them or urging them to voluntarily do the right thing?
Yeah, and there's a fight happening right now to fix Baltimore's inclusionary housing law, which for the last 17 years has created supposed to create a fund, which these developers were given tax breaks and in return were to build affordable housing. But basically that has not happened. The developers have gotten these tax breaks, but they have only built something like a few dozen units of affordable housing in nearly 20 years. And Baltimore faces a massive shortfall of affordable housing. The last time the the Section 8 vouchers were opened for the wait list was opened. They had tens of thousands of applicants applying for only a few thousand vouchers. Something like one in six residents faces housing insecurity in Baltimore. That's 100,000 people, and that shortage has only exacerbated as the housing stock, continues to deteriorate as these large landlords neglect the upkeep that these historic homes need. So I think the case sort of makes itself. The city has invested tens of millions of dollars with very few results. And so the alternative is investing in groups like Black Women Build Parity Homes that are helping residents rehab these old homes. And also things like community land trusts, where Baltimore has a movement, which I wrote about for another piece in Yes Magazine, that has spent years and more than a decade of activism to get the city to divert funds, which is happening for the first time. $20 million a year is going to building affordable housing. City funds, tax dollars are going towards that, but that's still sort of a drop in the bucket to what the need is. And so, you know, I think the housing justice activists have a really strong case that instead of investing hundreds of millions of dollars for developers, give that money to residents. You know, they have a vision for what will make the city livable. Baltimore is losing population. That is a huge threat to the city's future, because that means the city has to cut services, and it's losing political power in the state. And most of those residents leaving are longtime Black residents whose neighborhoods are no longer safe. They can't, the rents are increasing. And so if the city can attract and keep more of the Black working class that really built this city, that is the backbone of the city, it can be a much more livable, much more livable city, a place where people want to raise their kids, and a more just city. So I think they have articulated that vision, and it's just a matter of whether the political class, who of course, get a lot of donations from the very powerful real estate industry, if they are willing to invest in something different. And that remains to be seen if those in power are willing to look at the evidence and see what this standard trickle down economic policy has achieved, and then look at what housing justice advocates have achieved in the US and across the world, and see what is a better response for what Baltimore is facing.
Gisela, I want to wrap up our conversation with asking you to just hone in on one group in Baltimore who you mentioned in your story, Black Women Build, and you just brought them up in a minute ago as well. They sound fascinating. Tell me about this organization and what it does.
Yeah, so Black Women Build is a nonprofit, and they're working with the city to rehab some of the historic alley homes that are next to Sony E's and Poppleton. But they're a group that actually trains Black women on how to rehab and fix up vacant homes in Baltimore. Like I said, there's 15,000, which is more than enough to house every homeless person in Baltimore and put a major dent in the housing crisis.
But some of them require work to bring them up to code, et cetera.
And so that is the problem. They need a lot of work, and which becomes prohibitively expensive for communities that were denied opportunities to build wealth. And so Black Women Build gives specifically Black women who are the demographic that has the least access to the financing and the loans and the training to build up these homes. And they give them the hands-on training and experience to rehab these homes, make them livable, and invest, and have a chance to really build something that's their own. And so, they've already I think put up three or four houses they have rehabbed in the last year up for sale, or had the owners move in. And and this is on a small nonprofit budget. If they had the resources to do more work, then they certainly have a formula that could make a big impact in Baltimore.
Well, the moral of the story does seem to be that when grassroots organizations persist, that is where we see housing justice, rather than leaving it to elected officials and certainly to real estate developers. Gisela, thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to both of your stories from Rising Up's website. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Gisela Noor, a democracy program manager at Solutions Journalism Network and a contributor to Yes Magazine. He's written about housing justice in LA and Baltimore as part of a new series called Building the Block. You can visit yesmagazine.org to read his stories directly. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. This and other interviews can be found at risingupwithsonali.com by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.